At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
This is a More Than Just Podcast production.
Welcome to Spotcast, Season 7, Episode 31. My name is Tim Mitra. I am in Toronto, Ontario, and I'm joined by Jonathan Kuhlein in, for now, Jacksonville, New Brunswick.
No, Jacksontown. Come on.
Jacksontown, New Brunswick. Sorry, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's soon to be Florenceville, Bristol.
Yeah, but right now it's Jacksontown.
Yeah. Hi, how's it going, kids?
And then we also have Jaime Lopez Jr. in Seattle, Washington.
How's it going?
Maybe. I don't know. Maybe.
Maybe
you're not really in Seattle, are you? You're in somewhere else. You're not really in Seattle, are you?
No, I'm in the burbs.
He's in the burbs. All right. Wait, there's no fact check.
Once again.
What is going on?
The perfection that is podcast.
Did I even listen to last week's episode? Maybe I didn't. Thought I did. Maybe I didn't. Did I? Can't remember. Well, it'll be fact check next week if I didn't listen to this week's. Alrighty, let's move over to the headlines, and Jonathan's got some exciting news for us.
Exciting, yes. We'll call it exciting, yes. So, we knew that they were going to be making a new Lord of the Rings film, and by they, I mean Peter Jackson et al., who did the Hobbit trilogy and the original Lord of the Rings trilogy. The Lord of the Rings, The Hunt for Gollum is the name of the movie, and we knew they were making it, but we didn't really have a sense of the timing, and this week we finally got that news. December 17th, 2027, so a good year and a half away, which is fine, because obviously it takes a long time to make these things. So Andy Serkis himself, Gollum himself, is directing and starring in this, and Peter Jackson and his producing partner, Bram Walsh, are doing the producing. And it's nice to know sort of the timeline of this. It'll be interesting to see, given that the sort of only foray that this group's done into films since those two trilogies is the War of the Rohirrim, which we talked about that came out last year. This will be the first live action thing that they do, and it'll be interesting to see how well it is received, because you know, those movies are massive and they're very, very popular still to this day, but they're also 20 plus years old now for the original trilogy, and it'll be interesting to see if there's still a hunger there for this world. There's rumors that Viggo Mortensen and Ian McKellen, that they might come back and reprise their roles. Be always interesting to see how they do those things when they're older in real life, but younger as characters. So it'll be interesting to see how they pull that one off. But I don't know, you guys psyched for another Lord of the Rings film?
I was kind of wondering if they're going to have the prequel problem, too.
Well,
you know how it ends.
Yeah, that too. What do you think, Jaime?
It'll be... Well, let me ask a question. So this is The Hunt for Gollum, right? Do we know the sort of premise here? Because I think I have an idea of where it fits into the timeline, but...
Yeah, I think it's supposed to be in between The Hobbit and Fellowship of the Ring, and the idea is that this is the point at which, you know, in the beginning of Fellowship of the Ring, we have a little bit of a flashback scene where we see Gollum being tortured at Mount Doom for information about where the ring might have been. And so I guess the whole point of this is they're kind of setting it up like both the light side and the dark side are hunting for Gollum in this movie to find out what he knows, because there's this possibility that the ring is back, which is a little revisionist history. So it'll be interesting to see how they work that through, as you say, prequel problem. But that's the time frame, I guess, that we're working with is just a bit before the events of Fellowship of the Ring.
Okay, so maybe the best case for this is for it to be the equivalent of Rogue One, where there's not going to be stakes per se around, like, hey, does Gollum survive? Like, guess what? Spoilers, he does. and it will have to be other characters that we'll have to very quickly learn to love and then let go, because they presumably don't make it or aren't main line for the rest of the story. So it could work. So I'm going to give it a tentative positive.
Yeah. Interesting that there's also another film called The Hunt for Gollum, the short film on IMDb. I don't know who produced it or whatever, but yeah, weird. Interesting. I guess, I don't know. I guess it's a storyline, you know, the Smeagol story, right? The Adventures of Smeagol.
Yeah, which, you know, they do kind of flash back within the original trilogy of showing you that. And obviously you get more of that character in the Hobbit trilogy. Mm-hmm. So maybe there's a window there. And, you know, obviously these are very talented filmmakers. Maybe it will be good. I can't say that I have a huge desire to explore this time frame, but that's not to say that if it's not great, we won't enjoy it. So we'll see.
Will they do like a CGI version of Ian Holm, you know?
Yeah, I don't. I mean, how do they swing
walking through
that?
The gate at the end there? Yeah,
yeah, yeah. I don't know. Maybe what's his name, Martin Freeman will play.
Oh, true, right. He played the younger version.
Bilbo again. I don't know. Hard to say. The article also mentions that there is a new Evil Dead movie on the way. This is an article from IO9. Says that Evil Dead, the new version, is coming on July 24th, 2026, so just a little over a year away. Rumored to be called Evil Dead Burn. And there's also information about the new M. Night Shyamalan movie called Remain, which is coming in April 23rd of 2026. So, yeah, lots of nerdy goodness coming. Yeah. Speaking of release dates, the good folks over at Apple were playing with us this week by teasing that they were going to have some information that was clearly pointing towards the next season of Foundation, the Isaac Asimov-based series that they have had on for a few years. This is, of course, predates Silo and Severance and some of these other things, but and you know, people's mileage varies. I enjoy it. I thought the second season was a lot stronger than the first, and I'm looking forward to it. But they did throw some stuff out there, including a very beefy shirtless picture of Lee Pace to promote the fact that the third season is coming to Apple TV on July 11th, so not too long of a wait. And it's good because they didn't really hint when this was coming. This was just basically like, and go. And so we really only have, you know, 2 months wait before we're going to get the season. They did drop a little teaser trailer, so you can have a look at that. I like the show. I thought the first season was because it was on a very accelerated timeline, was a little hard to follow at first watch. And obviously, Tim, you've read the books, but it's a very, very complex galaxy spanning plus time spanning story, and then it slows down a little bit, although it does time jump a little bit in the second season too, so it can be a little much. This is what I would call hard sci-fi, not soft sci-fi. This is not Star Wars where it's a little easier to follow. This is like, pay attention or you will get lost. So yeah, I'm looking forward to it though.
Yeah, so one of my favorite characters from the Foundation series is the character of the Mule, which we're going to see in this, and it was like, I don't know if it was one of the first times we'd ever seen that, but there is a sort of Luca, I'm your father moment in it, that it has nothing to do with fatherhood, by the way, just sort of like giving you a parallel, you know, oh wait, what?
Yeah,
kind of thing. But you kind of sort of almost see it coming too, though, like in the book, right? Because it was written in this, the second Foundation was written in the late 50s, I think, right? But like I said, it was still one of my favorite sort of like twists in twist of the knife, as it were, right? In the whole prehistory thing. So the prehistory thing got a little tiring after a few books, but then, you know, then it kind of got in more interesting in the later 80s and 90s when he started writing more stuff, right?
Yep.
And did the whole robot series as well, but
yep.
Yeah, and I don't know, it's interesting how they're portraying the Emperor, because I don't remember that the Emperor being this sort of, you know, morning, what is it, morning or dawn?
I think it's dawn, morning, day, and dawn or dusk or something like that.
Dawn, day, and dusk.
Yeah.
I don't remember that. I do remember like the Emperor always being sort of there, but
yeah.
You know, interesting concept. Because I'm assuming this Lee Pace that we're seeing now is, because didn't they kill Dawn in the last last season?
Yeah, there was the culmination of the last season, without getting too deep into spoilers, was pretty cataclysmic for some of the regulars. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see how they recover that, and there will be another time jump too. So we'll sort of, our lead characters are putting themselves to cryogenic sleep and sleeping through stretches, okay. Right?
Hmm. So I was wondering why they were showing up again.
Yeah, so we'll get that moving forward a little bit, but. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how they keep moving this forward. Another 10 episodes, and this is Apple, so it'll come out week to week. So you'll be on that ride for 10 weeks. And they haven't said if this is a final season or if there's more to come. Obviously, as you know, Tim, there's a lot of runway for exploring this if it's successful. But it also, I think we talked about, it's an expensive show. Like, this is one of the ones that Apple is blowing a lot of dough on, so... Hopefully they get,
and it's no Severance, right? So
that's it. Like, I think you know, real sci-fi hardcores like it. I think some people like it because you know, it's filled with, you know, like, it's beautifully visual, but it's also, it's dense and it's complex, and you know, it's not quite as digestible as Silo or Severance or things like that. Not that Severance is easy watch; it's a thinker too. But I think it'll be interesting to see if there's enough juice there to squeeze more seasons out of this, or if it's going to rev towards a landing point, because I mean, obviously you can only spend this much money and this much time and all that for a while.
Yeah. And I don't think Foundation's really been tackled as the Foundation series has been tackled as a subject matter, right?
Well,
it is, like you said, it's pretty deep, right?
For years, they had called it unfilmable, right? They had years. Everyone had talked about, like, because, I mean, it's beloved, right? For a lot of science fiction fans, especially older science fiction fans, it's a beloved series, but a lot of people were like, I don't know how on earth you would make this. And even after the first season, people were like, I still don't know how you would make this, so...
Yeah, and well, they skipped over the whole space trucker thing, which is like the second half of the first book, right? So
yeah, and I think that's what they had to do, is kind of reimagine some parts, and also just omit things that were just too out there.
Yeah, they did what Jaime would call hand wavy space travel. At one point,
right? Hold my beer, we'll travel through space. Yeah. All right. The last thing I've got here is the trailer for The Long Walk dropped this week. The Long Walk is a very old Stephen King story that he wrote under the alias of Richard Bachman back in the late 70s, early 80s. He wrote a series of books. After he'd had some success, he decided to sort of test himself and see if he was just coasting on his name or if he was actually writing good books that would get noticed. And so he wrote four different novels under the name Richard Bachman just to see if people would notice. Eventually they did. They came onto it. Those books then became extremely popular. Famously, they collected them in a single edition called the Bachman Books that sort of was a compendium of those stories. That's how I read this and the story that became The Running Man and a few other stories that he put in there that are all... there's one book that's in there that apparently Stephen King is going to discontinue, just as a little digression. There's a story in there called Rage, and Rage is about a school shooting. And I remember reading it when I was probably 12, which is too young to be reading that. But I think I was probably somewhere between 11 and 12. I read the Bachman books, and the idea of somebody like snapping and going to school with a gun and taking hostages and killing people hadn't really been a thing at that point. And then it was, and it's gotten to the point in the world, but particularly in the United States, where it's epidemic. And so Stephen King has asked that they no longer publish that book. So I think in future collections of the Bachman books, that book will no longer be in print. But anyways, The Long Walk is a story about essentially that. It is a competition where you basically start and you are walking. And when you can no longer walk, you are shot and killed. And the last person walking is the winner. And so, you know, war of attrition.
Was it some sort of like Hunger Games kind of scenario? Like,
it's basically, yes, it's a dystopian kind of tale of, you know, You do this as a punishment, or you do this as a last resort, and you basically are, you know, followed at all times, and you know, yeah, you walk or you die is the catchphrase, right? So The trailer for this looks really, you know, grim and dark, but also really compelling. Like, it's a thriller as to, you know, who's going to survive. And, you know, you kind of know going in that most of the competitors aren't going to make it. But Mark Hamill's in there. We see a couple of scenes with him. And yeah, I mean, it looks dark and it looks, you know, intense. But if this is your kind of thing, it looks like it's really well made and interesting. So yeah, I don't know. You guys interested in or familiar with or interested in The Long Walk?
Oh, wouldn't normally be, but other than having watched the trailer here, but it's interesting. I didn't realize. So that's Mark Hamill playing the sort of older guy in the truck that's telling them the rules.
Yep.
Cool. It's like that guy in what was it?
Cool Hand Luke. You know, exactly. Yes. The yelling at Newman. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. What we have here is a failure to communicate.
That's the one. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. How about you, Jaime?
Not familiar with the story, but sounds like an interesting premise.
Yeah. Yeah. That Stephen King guy is pretty good.
Yeah. You read a lot of his stuff, right?
Yeah, I mean, when I was a young person, there weren't as many guardrails up for kids as there are now. So things like watching horror movies, reading books with extremely adult topics and stuff like that, you know, if you were reading a story like that, you know, people would be like, good for you. You're reading above your level. Not like, are you okay? retrospect, are you okay would have been a better question.
Yeah, yeah. Should you be reading the Bachman books? Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I read, you know, that and, you know, oh, God, so many. I really liked his short stories. So I would read, like, The Skeleton Crew and Night Shift and all these different Stephen King short stories that were just really messed up. Again, he's an incredible writer, very talented, but also dark, scary, intense. Yeah.
Apparently, Netflix is saying goodbye to Bandersnatch. Remember that? The interactive movie experience. Really cool for that era. They're going to go ahead and remove it from their service, which is a bummer.
Yeah, that was the one. I don't know. I only ever watched it once, but that was the one where you could choose. You chose the sort of path the story would take.
Yeah, choose your own adventure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Why? Does it say why?
They have a quote here. So this is an article from Engadget talking about a Verge article. It says a company spokesperson said the technology had served its purpose, but is now limiting as we focus on technological efforts in other areas. So unlike other things where there's like, oh, well, you know, this is like a tax refund or other sorts of things. I'm going to guess that this one is probably an engineering hassle to make it function across all of these various devices and TVs, rather than just play, pause, forward, back, you know, that sort of thing. Like, you couldn't really just watch this end to end, and it probably wouldn't feel good as like, well, select the chapters for what option B would have been 10 minutes in. You know, I think that's probably what that's actually happening here. But if anybody knows that there's, you know, some sort of weird rights deal or high price or something, I could be totally convinced of that too.
It could be a software upgrade thing too, because it does require bouncing around quite a bit, right? So from that could be a reason why they would do something like that, right? Like maybe they can't support that kind of bouncing around like they did. Because I guess it just jumps from chapters, right?
Yeah, and I think you could see new endings by finishing certain endings. And that was part of the play as well. It wasn't just a straight tree from what I remember.
Yeah, it's disappointing when these, like, again, it was, I wouldn't say it was the best story ever written, but it was an interesting experience to go through and use it. It's disappointing that option won't be there anymore, but I don't know. I mean, I really don't like it when any service removes original content that is good, it's disappointing. So I guess that's the only way to view this.
For this next one, I'm going to say first, praise Roy. Because the title here says, Disney says it made its Walt Disney robot to remind fans he was an actual person. So
robot.
There will be a Roy Disney, Keir Egan style robot available at which park did they say? Did they say which park? Main Street's Opera House in Disneyland.
Hmm.
There we go.
Interesting. Well, you can see him on. You can see Walt Disney on the Disney Channel if you have Disney Plus, right?
Yeah, but you got to like dig into the archives. Here, you can see him in physical form talking to you when you visit the park.
Well, that's just it. I mean, do people know that it's Walt Disney as opposed to just Disney, right? The youngins, I mean.
Yeah, it's far enough along that, like, you know, very similar. Do the youngins, when they're playing their Madden video game, understand, what does Madden mean? It's like, it's a dude's name who died a substantial amount of time ago that you, little one, may not have ever seen him in real life, you know, video. Yeah, what did he buy? When did he die?
John Madden's been gone for years, yeah.
Like a decade? Yeah, long enough that I guarantee you there's like 8-year-olds that are super hyped to get Madden for their birthday or Christmas or something, and they're like, have no clue who that is. They just know that the football game is called Madden. Oh, it wasn't that long ago, actually. I thought it was like a decade ago, and it was only 2021. 2021 was only 4 years ago. It feels like a decade ago. But yes.
Then he died, yeah.
But he had also been out of the limelight for a while, too. Like, he'd retired from even broadcasting for a while before he passed, so...
He
was kind of out of sight and out of mind for a lot of younger people.
Yeah, that's probably why it feels longer than it actually was.
Yep. Neat.
All right, well, we are at the main part of the show now, where we usually talk about something Star Trek related, but there's, again, a dearth of Star Trek stuff right now. Dearth, is that the correct word? I don't know. So we're going to talk about Andor Season 2. This week we're doing episodes 7 to 9, and then we're also doing Last of Us and Doctor Who with Jonathan and me talking about that one. But we'll start with Andor Season 2, episode 7, 8, and 9. So 7 was Messenger, 8 was Who Are You, and Welcome to the Rebellion for number 9. And I have a big question for later, but cool. What did you guys think about this week's triad of Arkishness, Android Arkishness?
I think it was overall pretty good, so I'm just going to put the three together. I think it does a really good job of getting us to some points that we knew needed to happen. I will criticize, I wasn't really a big fan of the end of Cyril and Dedra. I don't know that it really felt correct for the characters.
Right. Well, I watched a little bit of I was watching some of that thing just before we started recording today, and he pointed out that Andor and Cyril have a similar arc in that they both get radicalized, one towards the Empire, the other one towards the Rebellion. And Messenger starts out with Andor being pretty complacent about wanting to spend the rest of his life with Bix and not do anything for Luthen anymore, right? And then the brother, I don't know, is Wilmon his brother-in-law or something, or...
They're both from Ferrix,
So he's one of the Ferrix folks, and he's been off, and he's been spending, you know, he spent the end of the last series of three shows with Saul Guerrera, so he kind of became quite militant, I guess, in a sense, right? So, and that and Bix and where we go with this, the three, we're not going to spoil the end of Welcome to Rebellion, I guess. How do we convince Andor, you know, again, the prequel problem, how do we convince Andor to go from not wanting to be a leader is what they want him to be, right? A leader of one of the sort of lieutenants in the Rebellion to becoming what he is in Rogue One, right?
Yeah, it was always going to be the question. It was definitely the question that was on my mind as they made it clear. So the first season, there's a love between Bix and Cassian, but you don't really see it as a romantic connection. You just see that they love one another. You know that they have a history, but you don't really see that it has a future. In this season, it's been building around them really being connected and together and, you know, drawn back and forth to one another in a really strong way, especially in the wake of him rescuing her from torture and hell last season. It was always on my mind as we were watching it, how do they resolve Bix? Does Bix die? Because if Bix dies, then Cassian has, you know, that much more reason to fight. Does Bix leave, or does Bix like the relationship that Jaime mentioned between Dedra and Cyril on the Imperial side? Does it kind of devolve to the point where they don't fit anymore? It was always to me going to be an interesting resolution to that story, and to have it play out this way where they, you know, there is eventually a separation between the two of them makes perfect sense. And it does work as a motivation for the character. I did, like, I think Adria Arjona is, well, gorgeous, but she's really talented as well. And I think she's been playing that part really interestingly all season. It did feel like she was falling into that damsel in distress stereotype role of she's there to motivate the protagonist, which is one of the ongoing criticisms of you know, modern narratives. You know, man needs woman to just inspire him to do things, as opposed to being a person of substance and character. They'd done a good job of establishing her as a little bit more of an independent person when she sort of comes out from the last three episodes of finally getting her self over the torture and, you know, getting herself back on track. Here we see her living a pretty normal life. She's part of the rebellion. She cares. So it was definitely good to see her sort of coming into her own, and her decision to deliberately motivate him to do something by making it her choice, I think really changes for the better that character. It makes her much more strong and defined and a person of character, as opposed to just a motivating tactic for Cassian. So I think that was a really good move to redeem the character as the character on its own, right? But yeah, it was these three episodes were hard watches. I mean, beautifully made, so gorgeously filmed, the pacing of all three of them as you knew you were building towards this. So, you know, for Star Wars fans, your mileage may vary. If you know, if you watched and read and, you know, been in the weeds, you knew that Gorman was always destined to end badly. It is something that's referenced in Rebels. It's something that's referenced in other of the Star Wars media. Gorman was always known as the Gorman genocide. You knew that it was going to get really bad. And here we see, you know, they've been laying the foundations for this since the first episode of the season, of which, again, this is why it would have been nice to have this not three episodes at a time, but one episode at a time over 8 or 9 weeks, because that would have built the tension that much more. Here we're 3 weeks in, we've gotten this, but we knew that when they started talking about Gorman in the first episode, and we saw, you know, Ben Mendelsohn come out and say, like, we're going to strip mine this place, you knew that it was going to go badly. And then we saw Dedra's plan, and we saw Dedra's plan working. We knew it was going to go really badly, and damn, it went badly. Like, that scene as they're, you know, the Gormans are marching, and they're chanting, and they're singing, and they're, you just see the noose tightening around their necks. The tension in that second episode, Who Are You, is excruciating and really, really well done. The music, the pacing, that set. So apparently they built that square at Leavesden, out behind the studios. It's like, you know, what they said, 250 square meters or something like that. Like, it's a square. And so the way they were able to film in it, as opposed to filming in a volume or like a green screen set, the way they were able to actually, you know, tactily move amongst each other and around this circle square in the center of town, it just created so many interesting camera angles. And it just, I think it was a real testament to that type of filmmaking, as opposed to the sort of CGI heavy stuff that we've all kind of gotten used to, which is, you know, can be really, really impressive, but you're asking the actors to imagine circumstances. You're creating these sort of, like, there's going to be a wall there. Like, you kind of have to be artificial about it. Whereas here, it really feels like you could feel the claustrophobia in that crowd. You could feel the tension in the crowd as it starts to break and the Imperial starts shooting, and it just keeps getting darker and scarier. And yeah, like, something about that, just the way that it was filmed and the way that they built that set, was terrific. Really, really, really beautiful craftsmanship, and it really changed the way you make television or make a movie when you work in that kind of environment. And yeah, I was just blown away by that second episode. The first one, again, lots of stage setting, lots of sort of getting ready, but that second one, as we, like, because again, you know, it's not avoidable. It's like standing in the lion's mouth waiting for the jaws to close. It's so intense. And then we kind of knew where episode 9, Welcome to the Rebellion, was going, because we had a whole Rebels episode about what Mon Mothma did. And so, you know, those of us who are, you know, Rebels diehards, we had sort of seen how this was going to play out, but it was a real good twist, because there's no mention of a Cassian Andor in what we saw in Rebels, it was always, you know, this sort of glorious rebellion thing, and sort of to have that sort of twist of actually, you know, she could have been assassinated. She needed Cassian to bring their two stories together and do that again, really beautifully told, really, really well put together. And again, just that intensity of like, we know she does get out, but like, you know, maybe Cassian's going to get hurt here. Maybe Luthen's going to die. Maybe, you know, like it's intense. And they're like, they're all kind of ready for it. Like everyone's like, she has to get up. She has to live. The rest of us could die. Like, that's it. Like, this is the most important thing we're going to do. And you know where that story picks up in Rebels, which is, you know, her being transported through space and then making a second broadcast to basically double down. But that speech that she gives at the Senate, where she basically says, like, the Emperor is the bad guy and he is choking the truth out of the world, is so powerful and so beautifully done. And oh my God, Genevieve O'Reilly is just, oh my God, she's so good. It just, I'm just, I know I'm rambling, but my God, it was just, this is the best Star Wars thing that's ever been made. This is better. This is better Star Wars than Star Wars. Like it's so incredibly powerful television. It's so good.
So you knew the Gorman genocide was coming from having watched Rebels and stuff like that, or the rest of the canon?
Yeah, they mentioned it directly in there. You know, she says, you know, the Gorman massacre. It's a canon event that Gorman is, you know, but we don't know all the details.
We don't know what the purpose is. Yeah, I mean, and it's kind of a trope in history, actually, to do this kind of thing, to get quote unquote, I'm doing air quotes, insurgents into one place and then just open fire on them. And they did it in the Gandhi movie, because it really happened in India. You know, it's happened in you know, setting up the barricades and getting everybody cornered in there. So they're blocking all the exits kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
And you've got this dude coming in and taking over from Deirdrick, who's no longer in charge. Right. And he's brought these hapless, you know, untrained,
fresh recruits
who are trigger happy, right? Kind of, or hopefully trigger happy, right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, at one point, Deirdre's boss, I always forget his name.
Partagas.
He sort of says, Partagas. He's counting on the fact that the rebels will bring weapons into the arena, right?
Yeah.
Or they're not the insurgents, I should say. They're not rebels at this point. But, yeah, and I'm going to give a shout out to Dave Price on the team Slack, or our Slack channel, because he pointed out the episode from Rebels. So I went back and watched it after I finished watching these three, because I was thinking the same thing. Like, okay, he's, you know, the spoiled team from Bail Organa's, who was going to get her out of there. There was a sleeper in there, right? And that was going to work out. And Luthen knew about it. So he had Andor step in, and also to get Andor motivated towards working in a rebellion to get this very important person out of the Senate, because only he could do that kind of thing. Like, I guess it's like the sort of gist of this, right? Because he's so talented as a kick-ass bad guy, right? Or good guy, whatever you want to call him.
Well, he's a gray guy, right? Like, that's been the whole point of this series, is his descent into the gray, is that he starts out as, you know, no, I'm just a regular whatever, and then it just keeps getting darker and darker, and then it just gets blurrier and blurrier. So yeah, it's the gray zone, which I think is really fascinating.
So I was thinking the same thing as we're going, like, you know, as even as they're running down, and he calls out to the chauffeur, and then, you know, dispatches with him, right?
Yeah.
As part of the, and even shocks Moth Mothma with his action, right? Because how quickly he did that, right? And how skillfully he did it, right? Because he kind of like called the guy out, and, you know, by doing that, disarmed him, and then, you know, took care of him, because he was really a bad guy working for the Empire.
Yep.
But So I was thinking the same thing. I'm thinking, okay, well, they're going to jump in the plane together and he's going to bring her to Yavin, right? And then it was interesting that all of a sudden they're going to put her in a completely another transport. I'm like, what is going on here, right? And then, so I went back, and having watched the episode with, I'm trying to remember the name of it now. Dave called it out on our Slack. Give me one sec. It is Season 3, Episode 18, Secret Cargo, right? Mm-hmm. And then we have Hera and, you know, Ezra and the rest of the rebels who meet Mon Mothma in space and help her get to Yavin, right? Which is, so that made sense. Like, cause it was kind of like, again, that's the prequel problem again. Like I'm thinking of this, here's the solution. You've got this really good pilot, you know, can you get her out of sticky situations? And then why are they giving her to somebody else? Or why isn't she going traveling with him? I would have thought if I was her, I would have said, no, I'm sticking with you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like when they're having the cool down in the apartment, the what do you call it, the safe house, right?
So. Yeah. But it speaks to the sort of the grayness of the world that we're in here with Andor. And I think the reason why I'm responding to it as opposed to, you know, Star Wars has traditionally been very black and white. It's good versus evil. It's the evil empire versus the good rebels. And, you know, anything the rebels do as far as violence is justified because they are oppressed and blah, blah, blah. Here we see so much gray. And in that gray, we see, you know, the propaganda. We saw it in the first episode of this season when we have those two smarmy marketing guys inside a meeting with the Imperials who are like, don't you just hate the Gormans? Aren't the Gormans thinking they're all better than you? And they're like, they're planting these seeds for the fact that they want the larger sort of unwashed masses of the Empire to be like, yeah, the Gormans did this. They started it. They're the problem. And it's the same thing here where it's the rebels using that propaganda where they're like, yeah, it wasn't a black ops, you know, mercenary killer who went in there and murdered a couple of people to get her out. It was Gold Squadron and, you know, and Hera and the Ghost. And they're the ones that did this. And they brought her to Yavin and she gets to give this great speech. And it's all about image. And, you know, she's wearing white and she's the light and she's the leader.
Interesting that she's wearing the same clothing that she, like similar clothing. In fact, she drops her blue robe when which dovetails into the Rebels episode, right?
Yep. So I think again, this exploration of this, you know, the how the sausages are made in a rebellion versus the, you know, the posters is why this series is ultimately successful. And it's what makes Cassian such a compelling character is that he works on the fringe. You know, he and Luthen and the path that they've chosen to play in this rebellion, which sometimes requires hard choices of, you know, Takeholma's got to die, or, hey, I got to leave this person behind, you know, or I got to just put a gun to this guy's belly and kill him because there's no other options to it. That's not what you think about when you think about the glorious rebellion that, you know, you think about Luke and the Jedi and, oh, we're doing this to stop Darth Vader. But here we are, boots on the ground, and it's so much darker and complicated than what we've seen in the original movies. And again, that's the beauty of this show. It's the genius of Tony Gilroy is to just talk about all the different aspects of what a revolution, what a rebellion, what fighting back against an evil empire is like. Again, we talked about this over the past few weeks as we've been watching these episodes, but the parallels of the real world to what's happening in these episodes of, you know, her speech about the death of truth and, you know, the value of agreed truth in society and stuff like that. And, you know, what's her line? She says something about, you know, the loudest voice is, you know, the worst person. And, you know, like, it really does.
Yeah, the loudest
ring
monster.
Very true. Jaime, I got to know, like, sorry, I've been dominating this conversation just because I'm deeply in love with this, but I really want to know what your takeaways for this, because there are a lot of really strong echoes going on here.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot to see how, taking it a step back to the Gorman thing that's been building up for such a long time, where at the very tail end of it, even though the Empire has set up everything and has set up the propaganda, you know, they've got their like news anchors like, oh, like they're still counting the bodies at the naval base and that got blown up by the Gorman terrorists. And it's this powder keg, but it was technically the Empire that sets it off, right? So they have the sniper secretly there to do the pew, pew, pew first. And everything explodes into chaos, but there never actually was a Gorman citizen that fired first, which I thought was kind of interesting. And in the chaos, it's really hard to say who saw what, what's the official story. Obviously it gets covered over into the Senate of like, oh, you know, we lost so many citizens. We're super mad as part of that whole, charade, right? It's the politics side. And I really did appreciate the, like, okay, So not Jimmy Smits, Baylor Gannon. It's like, okay, so this dude said it's emergency. That dude says emergency. Nobody seems to be pushing back on the idea it's emergency. Since it is an emergency, I'm going to use this little known power to give my time to anybody, and I give it to Senator Mothma. Right. So even they learned how to play that side too, right? Yeah. Like, we're going to use the political machinery against the political machinery that's being used here. So I thought that was all really fascinating. The tension you get in the extraction of Mothma. Like, obviously we know Mon Mothma survives, obviously you know Andor survives. So this should normally have prequel problems, but we got a lot of other people, like, you know, her assistant that was secretly working for Luthen, right? Like, well, I didn't know that dude was going to survive.
He's in that Rebels episode, so we knew.
Oh, is he? Okay, I've seen Rebels, but I didn't remember that dude. So for me, I was like, oh, does that dude survive? I don't know.
Yeah.
When he yells to the you know, the turncoat within Bail Organa is like, she's a rebel spy, to distract her. I'm like, oh, he's going to get pew, pew, pew. Oh, no, wait, Andor's a little faster.
Yeah.
That was all really fascinating.
And the would-be killer is the character from season one, right? The woman, she's the one who, she was in the first season. She was the one that was like, they built a whole story around her in the first season.
I knew she looked familiar. I couldn't remember why.
I'm trying to remember which episode she was in.
So which lady are we talking about?
Keep talking. I'll find it.
This is the turncoat that was part of the three within Bail Organa's crew.
The extraction team who turns on them. She was in the first season.
Yeah. Really?
Okay. Boom. Yeah, I feel like she was like a undercover spy or something in the first season. I'm trying. Anyway. Again, great point, Tommy. I think the one thing we didn't talk about was like the conversation between not Bail Organa and Mon Mothma, where she realizes, like, they both realize that they're committing suicide in that moment. She can't ever stay and she's now going to go into the trenches. She's going to go work front lines rebellion as opposed to work from the Senate. He, in using this little ploy, is basically damning himself. He's done. He's done. And this is also the event that eventually leads to the dismantling of the Senate, which happens right at the beginning of Star Wars, the original 77, because Vader and the Emperor are like, enough. We're done with the facade of pretending that the senators have actual say. Like, we're done here, because this is what happens, right? But yeah, Bail is basically screwed at this point. Like, he's never going to be not watched. He's never going to be not under scrutiny. And that's why they target Alderaan. Ultimately, that's why Tarkin has him killed and has his planet destroyed, right? Like, this decision that he makes here for the benefit of the rebellion costs him and his entire planet their lives.
Yeah, there's a lot of that, although it's a little bit different because nobody's dead here. Bix deciding to give up the life that Andor wants with her, to say no, I believe in the rebellion, and he's so critical to the rebellion to, like, I'm going to leave elsewhere and give up this life together for a better life for all peoples. So that was
the refrain we keep hearing, is they can't win. They can't win. Like, we have to win. They can't win. If they win, everybody's life forever is ruined. Whereas, you know, like, so we have to sacrifice whatever it takes. Right. But not everybody realizes that. And like, I don't think I never thought of those stakes during Star Wars. It just never occurred to me that, like, I'm obviously, it's a movie, so you never think the bad guys are going to win. But like, here, they're basically saying, like, you know, we've all experienced so much. Everyone is suffering so much. If we don't win, like, that's it for people like us. You know? Yeah. Amazing stuff.
Anyway, the character is Beska, I think, played by Anna Ularu, the spy woman.
Oh, good. Yeah, she had an arc in the first season. I cannot recall how it ended, but I remember her.
Here's my big question. So I saw Diego Luna do an interview on Leno? One of those shows. Stephen Colbert, I think.
Oh, Colbert. Okay.
Colbert, or no, Jimmy Kimmel, maybe. Anyway, he was on there talking about clothing on Star Wars, and you know, Carol does costumes and stuff like that. So we're always in tune to sort of listen to conversations about costumes. And I remember him saying, Diego Luna saying that there are no buttons in Star Wars. We talked about this, right? Yeah. So my question for episode two, or I think it's maybe episode in the Messenger, the first one, right? You see Andor take off his shirt and put it back on again. And clearly it's using snaps, which are sort of pseudo buttons, right? So my question for you guys is, it's a costume question. Are snaps buttons?
No, they function differently. It's not a hole in an eyelid. It's a snap.
This is a weird one because I'm looking on Wikipedia and it says snap fastener, also called snap button, press stud, press fastener, etc., is a pair of interlocking discs commonly used in place of traditional buttons. There's a lot of hand waving here. I'm like, is it a button or not? Because you're telling me yes, but you're also saying no.
Yeah, because when I saw him take off his shirt, because he kind of does the... I used to have a Levi's shirt that had snap buttons back in the day, right? And you kind of could pull on it, and it would just open up, right? And you see him do that when he takes off his shirt. And then the camera shows him from the front, and he's putting them together, and I could clearly see a snap, right? the sticky out part. I'm not going to give it a gender, but the sticky out part of the snap where the other disc would snap onto it, right? So, just my big question for the day.
Yeah, it was...
I mean, of many big questions for this episode, there's lots of interesting things. I mean, like the resolution at the end, let's just try and talk about this without spoiling it, but the resolution at the end, one character makes a kind of a significant move to motivate Andor. Like, what do you think of that? Because you, Jonathan, you sort of, like something had to happen to Bix, for example, right? You said earlier, like if she dies, and is he going to go off the deep end? Is he going to become depressed and whatever? Like, you know, is he going to be like Frank and the Punisher, or, you know, where, how does he get motivated? And I think the person who makes that decision, I think they do it kind of rightly, but not, it's obviously going to mess him up a bit, right? But
yeah. And, you know,
because he's not focused because they're there.
We know where this character ultimately ends up, which is, you know, and we even get the line in the second episode of this week where Cassian first hears the line, rebellions are built on hope, right? And so he's picking up these little pieces as he goes of the ultimate character that we'll see when we get to him in Rogue One. And, you know, spoilers if you haven't watched Rogue One, but also why are you listening to us if you haven't? You know, he makes the ultimate sacrifice in there, as does the rest of the crew. But you don't start there. You know, you have to get to that point. And, you know, so here we're seeing all these jigsaw pieces fall into place that get you to that person. And the decision that happens and that affects him at the end of the second episode or the third episode definitely is a major piece falling into place of why he feels like that. That is an acceptable trade for him by the time we get there. And it's interesting, too, because you'd think that would be a natural place to end the episode, but then they sort of kind of throw you a PS tag as part of the episode where he's like, oh, my God, she's gone. Oh, my God, she's gone. And they're like, hey, by the way, we're playing Frankenstein's monster over here. Do you want to come watch? And instead of crying or screaming or whatever your natural instinct is, he's like, you know, got to go make the sausages. And he goes right back into this scene where we see, him bringing to life this KX droid, right? This monstrous, violent droid, which again, from Rogue One, we know, but really interesting to sort of see that, you know, his natural reaction isn't to dwell on the negative. It's to just, put that in his pocket and, you know, keep with the mission. It's just kind of, pretty interesting. Pretty interesting character development. Yeah,
and we get to see the KX droids in the Who Are You episode going off.
Yeah,
right?
like we saw a little bit of K2SO in Rogue One, but to see them like loosed on a crowd like that was some gory stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like I mean, essentially these are just... like, you know, yeah, they are. They're Frankenstein's monsters. They go around and they just kill.
Start hurling people.
And that's, I mean, the again, they did a good job of this to give us enough to care about from the Gorman rebellion, the Gorman, you know, insurgency, to have these characters that we care about, so that when they each have their moment of like, well, it's not looking good for that guy, and no, and that one where it's the sort of senior official's daughter who we've seen in multiple episodes. Yeah. And she starts sort of going away, and you're like, oh, well, maybe she's going to survive. And then she gets thrown for a distance, and you're like, ooh, never mind.
Yeah,
You know, that's very impactful. It's not, again, it's not a stranger. It's not just a random person, which we see that as well. But to see someone that we've now, you know, seen in multiple scenes and has a recurring role, and we know that's going to really hurt this poor old man who saw this tragedy coming and couldn't stop it. And yeah, there's so many layers to these episodes and this show. I saw an interview with Tony Gilroy recently where he was talking about, you know, he's like, I had all this stuff that I wanted to say about authoritarianism and rebellion and revolution and all this stuff. And he's like, I never knew where I could use that because I'm a filmmaker. I never thought I'd have a chance to really just talk about all the things that interested me in talking about what, you know, what starts a rebellion, what starts authoritarianism, how do we get here, all this stuff. And he's like, they said to me, like, you can have 24 hours of filmmaking to tell this story. And he's like, I finally had a place where I could just talk about how dirty and ugly and messy and complicated these kinds of situations are and just throw it all out there with these characters. And he's like, that's what made me want to do television. He's like, when I'm done this, I'm going to go back to making films. I'm not doing this again. But he's like, I couldn't pass up the opportunity to really just talk about what I think is, you know, important about human history. He's like, I read all about all these different revolutions over human history of how this works. And, you know, he's like, there's a reason why these people are speaking pseudo French, you know, like all these things are tied to historical events. And, you know, and as I say, like, it's hard not to see the parallels between this and modern times, you know, some of the things that we've seen. It's really, it's just exquisite television making. I said it before the season started, that, you know, I think Andor is the best show I've seen in the last decade. And I'm doubling down. It's the best show I've seen in years. It's the best Star Wars thing ever made. It's extraordinary.
Cool.
Now, a word from our sponsor.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Now, back to the show.
All right, well, let's move on to the next show, which is The Last of Us.
Yeah, which had its work cut out for it this week because... because Andor was like dropping the Oops All Crunchberries episodes, so we get not a quiet episode, but not a banger either. So yeah. So,
but it was season 2, episode 4, day 1, which is this episode from the game was a challenging level, right? It's one of those ones where they come across the wolves, right? Mm-hmm. Ellie and Dina. Yeah. And they have to sort of survive this, you know, broken down building and, you know, run between floors and escape and, you know, and plus I think there's also clickers and howlers in there too, right?
Yeah, I mean, the action scenes in this played out, it felt very video game-ish. It had that, like, you know, you have to go here and you have to hide here and you have to move on to this part and you have to go into the train car to get past the people, but they're busting through the wind. Like, it had a real video game kind of vibe to it. For sure. Yeah, I mean, this was a roller coaster ride. I want to ask Jaime. So here we are in Seattle, Jaime. You know, we joked about it last week that, you know, we're finally there in Seattle. Was this a recognizable kind of Seattle vibe or did it feel very Vancouver? We talked about that.
Yeah, I mean, kudos for them. They name drop Capitol Hill. I'm like, okay, I got it. I know which neighborhood they're in. They show a gate that says Capitol Hill. I'm like, oh, my significant other and I'm like, is there one? I'm like, I want to call nonsense, but there might also be some weird like alley that has that little gate. You know, I'm like, okay, I'll give them a pass until I do more research before calling it. The Lake Hill part had us confused. We're like, what are they calling that? Because the closest things you can find in Google are like over in Bellevue, which would be on the other side of the lake. So kind of like if this was like San Francisco Bay Area, it'd be like, well, there's Oakland over there and then there's San Francisco here kind of distance, you know. But otherwise, you know, but pretty good. You know, it wasn't terribly obvious as like a Vancouver, even though it probably is filmed there, you know. So kudos to them for that stuff.
Yeah.
What about the subway station? Was that like a named, or did they even show the name of the subway?
It's plausible, especially given that they're in Cap Hill. I'm like, okay, it's plausible that they would go down that deep, you know, get to the light rail piece. You know, it goes underground at that point. I'm like, okay, you know, I could see that. Yeah, still
is that
plausible.
The same light rail that goes to the where the old Expo was?
See, it's not the monorail. It's not the one that goes to the Space Needle. This is the light rail that, you know, it goes pretty far north, north of Seattle. It comes from Linwood down to through Seattle and then to the airport, SeaTac Airport, right. Is the, okay. The biggest piece. So, yeah, the transit part, I'm like, okay, that makes sense. They haven't anything about timelines. Would they have had this part? Probably close enough, you know, because we discussed the accuracy of the Space Needle of, like, if you had a timeline where they had, you know, Cordyceps zombies, would you have done the renovations? No. Therefore, you'd have the big wiry birdcage Space Needle. So I'll give them a pass on this stuff, you know, B+, at least.
Yeah. So I guess the big part of this episode was where they kind of figured out that the wolves were not going to be the knockover that they thought maybe they might be. And also the revelation that that Dina is going to have a baby, which, combined with that, they changed the timing, but that they finally, the hookup between between Abby and Ellie, right? Or between Abby, Ellie and Dina, right? It, I think, was really well handled. Like, To have Dina sort of have this moment of, I'm pregnant, but also I'm in love with you, and, you know, and I've always been queer, but I just kind of forgot that I was queer. Like, you know, that it felt kind of true. It felt very, like, you know, identifiably the queer experience, right? You know, my family told me not, I couldn't be queer, but, you know, I, in the end, I'm in love with you, and that's what it is, right? I thought that was really quite well handled by those two actors, and their connection, like, it feels real. I must say, I didn't know a lot about Isabella Merced. I've seen her in a couple things. I had seen her most recently in the ill-fated what was that horrible, oh, Madame Web. She was in Madame Web, and painfully underutilized in there, but again noticeable in that as well. Famously, she was Dora in the Dora live action movie about 5 or 6 years ago. So, you know, she's been around, and, you know, she was a teen star on like Nickelodeon and stuff like that. So she's been around for a lot of people. I had seen her in a couple things. She was in Sicario. She was in, she was in Alien Romulus last year. But, and she's going to be in the new Superman movie. Like, this is kind of her year. She's kind of breaking out this year. I'm really enjoying her. I think she's really compelling, and she's a really nice counterpoint to Bella Ramsey. Sorry about that. She's a really good counterpoint to Bella Ramsey because she is, you know, so much more sort of, just charming and outgoing, and just their personalities, the way they sort of complement and yet contrast each other is really, really good. And the chemistry between the two of them as actors is really strong as well. So it'll be, I think a lot of people were a little apprehensive when, obviously, the event of episode 2 that, you know, straight out of the game. But, you know, part of what I think we loved in the first season was this sort of the banter and the relationship between Joel and Ellie. Here, I think a lot of people were like, hey, no more Joel. That whole vibe is gone. But I think Isabella Merced as Dina has really kind of picked up the slack and become quite enjoyable on her own.
Yeah, I thought this was also a pretty interesting way to let somebody else know that Ellie is immune,
mm-hmm.
right? And have that tension of like, oh no, is she going to shoot Ellie in the head, because you would logically do that. Thank you for saving me, friend. You kept me from getting bitten, but now you are bitten, and rather than you becoming a zombie and killing me, I'm going to have to take you out. Having to have the tension there, I thought was pretty good. And I don't recall, who knows? Joel knows. I don't think Tommy does.
I think it was really only Joel.
The second person who knows,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Just Joel?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and especially in the wake of what happened in Salt Lake City, I think she's pretty protective of that. Although we see her recklessness in the first episode where she gets bit on the stomach, right? And we know, like, it's a good reminder for the audience. Oh, yeah, she's immune and nothing can happen to her other than being, you know, shot and dismembered and whatever. But it was definitely that. And yeah, to see Dina's reaction of like, well, I'm going to have to kill this person I love was pretty intense, too, right?
Yeah, immediately too. Like that's sort of like there's no question about that. That's kind of how they survive.
Well, because we see that in there's a very quick cutaway scene in episode 3 when they're doing the cleanup in town, and there's a guy who's sitting on the wall, and he's like there, and he sort of holds up the bite mark and hands somebody a gun, and then they sort of pan away, and you hear "Ptoom," and you know. Of course, that's, you know, for most people, that's the mercy, right? Is, you know, hey, I'm done here. So like, let's just get it over with. And that's where Dina finds herself is like, I guess I'm going to have to do this to this person I love.
Right. Which is challenging, I guess, you know.
I mean, I'm going to find it hard when I have to put down my family members, but that's just me mostly. I can't speak for everyone, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm going to struggle, just so you know. I'm going to struggle with it. It's not going to be as easy as it seems here.
No, good episode. I enjoyed it. I mean, again, having played the game, this is like right off the disc, you know? Yeah.
Well, and again, credit to Craig Mazin and Neil Druckmann, who, you know, they worked, was it Mazin or Druck? I can't remember which one of them worked on the original game. But, you know, it is both telling a more rich story and a more human story, but also it does kind of feel like a video game. It does kind of have these like, oh my gosh, how are they going to get out of this? You know, kind of, you know, the have to sneak through windows, have to creep around kind of thing, you know, mixes of both the stealth with the action, with the emotion. Like they really have done a lovely job of capturing the type of vibe that the game has. It does make me mad though, because I'm like, if they can do this, why is the Uncharted movie so damn bad?
Yeah, well,
like those Uncharted games are incredible. They're so much fun, and I'm like, do this, just do this.
It's a tough thing. You know, this hews very closely to the original material. I get the impression that the Uncharted movies do not hew very closely, but I will also give you a Sonic the Hedgehog series does not stay very close to the actual, like what happens in the games, but that doesn't matter because it stays close to the spirit.
Hmm.
And maybe that's the answer here, right? You can be sort of slavishly close to material and kind of miss the point, and you can be very different from the material, but really nail it in like, yeah, that's what we want. I feel like people are saying similar things about the Minecraft movie of like absolutely nothing to do with the game, but really nails the game is what I seem to understand of it. If that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So
I mean,
once again,
you can talk about,
you know, it's art. There's a lot of different ways to get it right and get it wrong. It's not a science. If it was a science, it would be science.
Yeah.
It is what it is.
Well, what it is great television. Again, our cup runneth over.
Yeah. All right. Should we talk about the doctor, the good doctor?
Yeah. Let's,
Doctor Who.
Let's do some Doctor Who.
So, yeah, this episode is, again, we're season 2, episode, what are we, 7, I think?
Nope, I think this was
6, 5, 4, 3, 2.
4. We're only 4 episodes, it just seems like longer.
Yeah, well, lucky Dan. Oh, yes, so this was an interesting one because, yeah, we got back to Ruby Sunday, mm-hmm. right? So it was a completely different bit. I mean, the Doctor appears briefly in this episode, but it's another. We'd had episode like this last year, which was really good, where Ruby goes off and does the 73 yards episode, where she trips. She does a butterfly effect kind of thing, and has to sort of solve this problem, right? That she creates, and the Doctor's not in. You know, Chidigat was not in that episode much. He's in the beginning and very end. So it's interesting that we got back Ruby Sunday, who we kind of, I had heard that she was coming back, but this is sort of a separate chapter, if you will, because it's not the Doctor and what's her name? Velma, the new girl, the new companion.
Oh, she's Belinda. Yeah.
Belinda. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, you know, people like Varda is the name of the new girl. But the actress, I mean, so Millie Gibson back as Ruby, kind of a, you know, you could skip it if you needed to episode, right? From the point of view of like an arc for the year, for the season, right? So what did you think of it, Jonathan?
Yeah, I mean, I like Millie Gibson as Ruby. She's just a very charming person. So I was excited to see her back. I haven't really clicked with Belinda as the companion yet. She just hasn't quite had it yet for me, the relationship between the two of them, whereas I thought the relationship in the first season between the Doctor and Ruby was stronger. So I was happy to see her back. And it was interesting the way they sort of told this story about, you know, her and this relationship, and then, you know, this other character and his sort of complex backstory, and you know, and then obviously this whole thing that sort of ties into this conspiracy and UNIT and all this other stuff. It was a little bit all over the place, but there was definitely some good stuff in there. And I like the fact that there was this sort of thread of like, this wasn't just a side mission. This actually ties into the larger something. We did see Mrs. Flood show up again. So there's definitely sort of a larger play here than just the standalone episode. But yeah, overall, you know, like they've done these before where like it kind of focuses, famously last season, they did the episode where, you know, Ruby is sort of trapped in a period of time and the Doctor's not there. And so we kind of get to focus on her. And I think that was one of the stronger episodes from the first season with Judy Gatwa. And I think this one, it was sort of similar in that we get a lot less Doctor. He's sort of in the periphery of all this, and we kind of get a chance to sort of really soak up the other characters. It did make me kind of pine a little bit for the first season and just the relationship and her mom's and her grandma and stuff like that. Like I did find myself being a little wistful for it as I was watching this. You know, ultimately this is a bit of an emotional roller coaster for the Ruby character. And, you know, I hope that this isn't the last we see of her, because I feel like if this is the last time we see Ruby, it would be a very sad and frustrating way to sort of leave that character. I'm hoping that at some point in the remaining four episodes this season, we're going to see more of her and the Doctor and Belinda, and maybe that will, there'll be a little chemistry change that will make things for the better. So I'm hopeful. I'm not.
So do we know why she is only in the show for a short period? I mean,
I don't know. I don't know what the rationale was for having a one and done kind of companion. Like it's less common for them to do that. Usually companions are on for 2 to 3 years, as doctors are. Usually they sort of alternate them so that they don't, you know, completely reset all at once like they did at the beginning of this new run. But I don't know if she was just, you know, she didn't want to be tied down to a show for 3 years, because, you know, 3 years of 3 years of television making is about 5 years of real life. And, you know, it's not for everybody to want to be the same character over and over again for that long.
Yeah. Well, I mean, she came out of Coronation Street. She did like 3 years on that, right?
Well, so, as a character. That's a perfect example, though. She may well have been like, you know what, I just did years on a show. I don't want to do more years on a show. So, I mean, does any of this make Doctor Who's season seem more appealing, or does it make it seem less appealing? Like, obviously, you haven't had a chance to sit down and watch it, but you're also, I know, a casual fan. Are you more engaged with this, hearing what Tim and I are talking about, or are you like, maybe I'm fine?
I feel like I'm fine where I'm at. It sounds a little strange to me. Even if it was like, yeah, I'm not sure if I want to commit, I'm like, okay, thank you, next. It's like, find another actor, then. I don't understand the, unless it was like really alluring, oh my gosh, like this is the only time we can get this person that's so perfect. It still feels a little weird that you would cycle through that quickly.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's the history of the show. It's what they do, right? They They have built this thing in from the beginning of the franchise where they can be like, well, we don't have to be beholden to this one person. But I mean, just in the same way that it was jarring when they first brought it back and they brought in Chris Eccleston was the Doctor for the first season. And after one season, he was, you know, in and gone already. And you were like, well, that's different. I think same thing with the companion when they're like one and done. You're like, hey, wait a minute, what? So, yeah, I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing. I don't dislike the character, the actor who plays Belinda. And I don't dislike the character Belinda. She just... We've only had like three episodes with her, so we really kind of haven't had a chance to get to explore their dynamic and to get to know her really well. And we didn't get a lot of backstory with her. She was really in the first episode she appeared. She was basically, it was like, here's a quick glimpse of her life that lasted a few minutes. And then it was like, and you're off on your adventure. So we don't have these sort of like depth with the character yet. Maybe it'll come around. I don't know.
Yeah. Do you kind of have to wonder how much Disney and its money meddling? I mean, it certainly helped in the production values point, yep. But if the execs are going to tinker perhaps a bit too much with the success here, then maybe they need to sort of, you know, continue to write the checks, but maybe just
leave
hold your tongue a little bit.
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I talked about it at the beginning of the season, like, I don't know where they're going with this. And for a series that's as storied as Doctor Who, to get to that point is never a great thing of, like, so we're just going to kind of throw stuff against the wall and hope that it sticks, and maybe if we put some more money into it, it'll be better. I don't know. But, yeah, I guess we'll see how this season plays out. We're halfway through the 8-episode planned season, so maybe it'll pick up. There's definitely a larger narrative that's happening in the series. There is a sort of larger arc that connects these episodes. And maybe if they pay that off well, it'll all seem like it's worth it in the end. But it has been a little bit inconsistent, which is disappointing. But that being said, this was a good episode. I would say if you enjoy the Ruby Sunday character, then here you are. You want to move on to our watch list? You and I are up first. We can jump in here.
Sure.
All right. I watched Star Wars Tales of the Underworld, which premiered on May the 4th, as it does. So this is the third in the series of short animated series that they have been putting out on May the 4th the past 3 years. They did Tales of the Jedi. They did Tales of the Empire. And this is Tales of the Underworld, which is focused on two characters that don't really fit into those nice clean boxes of good and evil. We get three short 50-minute episodes on Asajj Ventress.
My favorite character, yeah.
And then we get three episodes on Cad Bane, another character that is probably closer to the dark of the darkness in the universe, but interesting to go back and explore these characters. For Asajj Ventress, we're looking forward from where we kind of knew she was. Now, we knew that she was alive because she had shown up in the Bad Batch, even though she had canonically died in one of the Star Wars novels that came out over the past number of years, where there was a whole story about her working with Quinlan Voss on creating the path and trying to get the survivors of Order 66 to safety. She famously dies in one of those books, which was a disappointing end. While I realize those books are at times excellent, they just don't obviously have the same gravitas as the TV programs. They don't have the maximalist appeal. They don't reach as many people. So I think for a lot of people, they didn't even know that she had theoretically died. And here we kind of get the answer to, wait a minute, how is it possible that she's alive during the Bad Batch era when, you know, she was theoretically killed? And here we get, you know, the starts off with us getting to understand how she survived and then exploring sort of what she does going forward from having survived that twist and sort of leading us to where we find her in Bad Batch. So that was satisfying for me. Asajj has always been one of my favorite characters. The weird, violent / sexual tension relationship between her and Obi-Wan throughout Clone Wars is actually pretty iconic. I actually really like the sort of she's trying to kill Obi-Wan. Obi-Wan's trying to flirt with her while they're having sword fights kind of thing that happens throughout Clone Wars that I really like their dynamic. So I really enjoyed the character. I loved her debut in the original Gideni Tartakov, that animated Clone Wars series that they had, those little short 5-minute episode ones. She famously appeared in there for the first time, and she's just like incredible in that series. So I was really happy to get more time with her and to get to unpack some stuff about this character, who is extremely complex. You know, she's Dooku's assassin and his acolyte, theoretically his apprentice, grooming her for when he plans to take over from Palpatine. Of course, that's not how it works out. And then in the course of Clone Wars, of course, it kind of falls apart for her. So, yeah, happy to see more of that character. The Cad Bane episodes, you know, really are an origin story of, you know, here he is as a little kid growing up. Again, that episode, your mileage may vary, you know, I guess it's a formative experience, but we see him as a little kid and sort of some of the things that form who he becomes. And then the whole sort of 3-episode arc is about him and his childhood friend. They both end up on different sides of the law, and then they end up in conflict. It's a pretty well-worn trope of, you know, childhood friends, but they're on the opposite sides. You know, it didn't feel quite as fresh, but also Cad is such a compelling character that by the time you get around to the 3rd episode, and they basically did an homage to High Noon, the classic movie from the 1960s. And, you know, Cad Bane's coming in on the noon train. He's looking for revenge. He's going to do this thing. It was, you know, as a fan of that movie and a fan of, you know, that kind of storytelling, it was kind of fun to see that play out and the parallels. Obviously, someone there is a big fan of that stuff. But, yeah, I would say I really enjoyed this. I like that they do these Tales of series. They don't, you know, they don't take long. The animation is crisp. It's a nice evolution from what we saw in Clone Wars and Rebels. It's not quite as cutting edge or avant-garde as Star Wars Visions, but it definitely is pushing what they have established. And yeah, I like that we're getting a little bit deeper exploration. I like the stuff we got before about, you know, the origins of Dooku and, you know, what happened with Ahsoka after Order 66 and in between her happening in Clone Wars and what happens in Rebels. Yeah, I think these things are great. Jaime, just curious, did you watch this week as well?
I've only seen the first 3, so I haven't gotten to the Cad Bane ones yet.
What did you think?
Yeah, I was enjoying these. I thought they're pretty solid.
Yeah.
I've only seen the first 2, but yeah, they're short. They're not like huge, you know, it's not a huge commitment.
Yeah, I mean, it's less than an hour and a half. You're done the entire 6 episodes. Like it's not a huge commitment as far as time, and they are very sort of digestible. So not a big ask, I would say. And I think that's about right. It just feels like a nice little treat. Like, hey, you made it to another May the 4th. You have a little Star Wars, and you know, go sit and watch some Star Wars for a while, and you know, we'll see you next year.
Well, the Clone Wars episodes were pretty short, too, like when they first came out, right? Because they were almost fillers. Yeah,
because they were on actual network they were on cable. They were in Cartoon Network. So they were with commercials. They were only 22, 23 minutes, right? So
Yeah. Just I always thought they had grumpy Yoda in them.
You know? Yes. Yeah.
Grumpy Yoda.
Yes.
Congratulations on the U.S. Pope there, Jaime.
Yeah. First American Pope. From Chicago, and enjoys the White Sox. That's his team.
I laughed immensely when I saw someone post on social media that America or Chicago got a Pope before it got a quarterback that could throw for 4,000 yards. That made me laugh really hard.
Yeah,
that made me laugh so hard. Yeah. All right. What you got for your watch list this week, Jaime?
That was a segue.
Yeah, the significant other and I knew that the conclave in real life was happening this week. So we said, you know what? Which service has conclaves? Surely one of them does, because it's been long enough since the Academy Awards. And sure enough, it's on Prime Video. I checked both in the USA and Canada. So y'all should be okay. So if you got Prime Video, it's free on that. And it's a pretty good movie. It doesn't feel like a 2-hour movie. Feels pretty, I wouldn't say it's easy breezy because it's serious drama that's going on, but it doesn't feel ponderous and long, which I appreciated. So, you know, they don't normally resolve themselves as quickly as they did in real life here. What did they go, like a day and a half? They went into the second day of voting. This movie goes, spoilers, into further rounds of voting than what we saw in real life.
Have you ever seen The Shoes of the Fisherman?
I have not.
Anthony Quinn, an old 60s movie. Same sort of, I mean, and I couldn't say it's the same thing, because I haven't watched Conclave yet, but it's about the whole voting process.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I will also say the movie trailers overemphasize the Isabella Rossellini character. To be clear, she's a very important character, but the movie trailer makes it seem like she's going to be like, you know, Batman and Robin with Ralph Fiennes. Like, it is not at all like that. Like, she's a relatively minor but important role in the story. So this is kind of like the VHS and DVD jackets for Chocolat, which prominently feature Johnny Depp. He's in there for like 5 minutes of screen time. Yeah. So same problem there. Yeah, they heavily wanted to boost her. I'm like, you got Ralph Fiennes, you got Stanley Tucci, you got John Lithgow. Like, there's a pretty stacked deck. She plays a really important role, does it really well. But if you were in there like, wow, I can't wait for an hour of her role, like, you're going to be very sadly disappointed. Don't go in with that expectation.
Well, I mean, it is a boys' club to begin with, right? So that would be surprising.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway. It's just the trailer, like, made it seem like, oh, given how much time and emphasis, like, surely she's got, like, 30 minutes. I'm like, I don't think she does.
Well, I mean, I saw a trailer the other day, and I just completely unrelated to sci-fi, but I thought it was interesting. It's based on some of the stuff that we've seen in the past, and we talked about on the show as a new show. Apparently, it's it's called the Department Q, and it took a while to figure out what the name of it was, but it's basically set in Edinburgh, and it's a, you know, cop story, cop drama sort of thing. And I'm hoping it's kind of like Slow Horses, Slow Dogs? What's that another show called?
Yeah, Slow Horses.
Slow Horses, yeah. I always get that mixed up with Slow House, right? But anyway, yeah, and Kelly MacDonald was in the trailer, which is why I kind of thought, Kelly MacDonald. Cool. But she's playing Scottish in this one.
Even better. I think every man my age is deeply in love with Kelly MacDonald from Trainspotting.
It's Trainspotting, oh, yeah, 100%. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. Anyway, that's all I got for this week. It's like you said, John, it's tough watching all this stuff and trying to get it all squeezed in, right?
Well, the three episodes of Andor is again, it's,
that's the killer.
It's amazing, 'cause it's so good, but I mean, it's like going to a steakhouse and just like gorging yourself. And
yeah, it's like watching a really good movie once a week for 4 weeks.
Yeah, right? Which is, again, yeah, it's an incredible experience. I still think this would have been ultimately more satisfying if it was stretched over 12, just because I think it would have given more time to digest the beauty of the filmmaking that they're doing here. But it's a demand too. It's a bit of a grind. And, you know, I don't feel like sometimes I'm giving them as much like time and digesting them as much as I'd like to. I know that this is going to benefit from multiple rewatches, and I know I'm going to rewatch Andor many times because it's just so wonderful. But yeah, it's a lot. And again, you, poor Doctor Who is just not keeping up with the rest of the bus right now. And, you know, Last of Us is one of the best TV shows on right now. Andor is the best television show on right now. It's hard to keep up.
Yeah, and so we're finishing it up next week, right? Like the last three episodes, right?
Final three episodes of Andor. We only have three more episodes of Last of Us and four more episodes of Doctor Who. We're gonna need some. We're gonna need some Star Trek sometime soon. We need a release date.
Yeah, we don't have a release date.
No,
yet.
No, we know we're getting another season this summer. We're getting another season of Strange New Worlds.
Oh, you know, we didn't talk about the elephant in the room, which is sort of our headlines here. We should have talked about 47 and his desire to put 100% tariff on movies and television
produced outside,
filmed outside the United States.
Yeah, I looked at that story for us to talk about. Why don't we do that one in our after show? Because that seems like a whole other conversation.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it's interesting because I do have a perspective from a number of people I've talked to this week who work in the movie industry. Yeah. Anyway, so for now, let's wrap it up. And so, hey, Jonathan, people want to get in touch with you. Where do they find you?
Well, you can look around rural New Brunswick, or you can try on Instagram or Blue Sky as @JPKNews, or YouTube at youtube.com/@JPK.
And Jaime, if people want to find you on the set of Last of Us?
Besides perhaps seeing me in the Capitol Hill area, just use the waypoints that they show you in the series to navigate around. I'm sure you'll be okay. Otherwise, they can find me online on Instagram as @DevOfTheHair.
All right. My name is Tim Mitra, T-I-M-M-I-T-R-A, on Blue Sky, Mastodon, Reddit, Stack, Substack, all kinds of different places you can find me with that particular handle. So until next time, we'll see you in the future. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to the Spotcast Podcast. If you want to find out more about the podcast or see the episode show notes, visit the Spotcast website at spotcast.com. If you have feedback or questions, you can get in touch with us on the website. If you like the show, please consider recommending us to a friend, writing a review on iTunes, or pledging any amount at patreon.com/spotcast. You can find details on how to help us on our website, spotcast.com/sponsor us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in the future.
That we were on a list of top 100 sci-fi shows, and I didn't think it was worthy of putting in this thing because we're number 55.
Ooh, we're better than 55.
We're on the list, though. Yeah, 55. Yeah. But that's not Star Trek. That's like sci-fi. So well,
it's good.
Yeah, I don't know. I think these guys are just these people who put you on lists. But half the time, I think they want you to subscribe to some service or whatever.
Well, you know, it's good, but it's no Golden Globe good.
No, not yet. We're working up to that.
Jaime, you're responsible for our West Coast publicity. We expect to get a nomination in the next couple of years.
Yeah, that's there's a chance for the Golden Globes, right?
How's that? Oh, because they're doing podcasts now?
Yeah, yeah. So there's a chance.
You're telling me there's a chance. You're
telling me there's a chance. Yes, yes.
What's that from?
Dumb and Dumber.
Oh.
Yeah, it's when the Jim Carrey guy is like, you know, in love with the main girl, and he's like, "Just tell me, is there ever a chance for a girl like you, a guy like me?" She's like, "One in a million." So you're saying there's a chance?
Yeah. Yeah. So I thought about adding about this story about 47, but I didn't know where to go with it because it's tied in with some very complex politics and some very complex global relations stuff. But
and it's just dumb because I mean, if you look at something like I was talking to a friend of mine who's in the industry and he was saying that, you know, if you look at something like a Tom Cruise movie, like the Mission Impossible ones, they're shot in like 27 different locations, like. And produced there, I mean, because of all the sci-fi and, yeah, all the special effects
and
stuff.
It's one thing
right?
to shoot a movie that is supposed to be in other places and have them be other places. It's another one for something like Wednesday, which is the Netflix series with Jenna Ortega. I really enjoyed the first season. I was surprised when I read about it that she said the most challenging thing about doing it was they shot in, I think it was like Romania or something. It was somewhere in Eastern Europe. You know, there's no indication it's set. You know, it's set in America, like, but they did that purely because they were getting so many subsidies and, you know, incentives to film there as opposed to filming in America. And, you know, obviously Canada has extremely benefited from productions moving outside of America for, you know, cost savings and everything else. Vancouver and Toronto are huge film and television production hubs and have been now for decades. I guess I understand it. I mean, you can make a case that intellectual property and entertainment is what America's business is now. So I understand why you'd want to be protective of it. Although I think if you're going to do things, maybe, I don't know, protect the rights of creators in places like China and the Middle East that are like wildly pirating and taking advantage of those things, that would be a good start. But I don't know. I'm not sure that this is a solution, but I guess I understand the instinct to protect that industry. But I think it comes back to the same thing when it comes to the manufacturing discussion. You know, 47 has talked about wanting to bring so much manufacturing back to the United States, but there just is not enough human beings and infrastructure and supply lines and all these different things to bring those jobs back to the United States. There's not enough physical workers. The population of America is 5 times smaller than it is in China. That's why there's so much more manufacturing production in China. It's the same thing with filming. Like, what are they going to do? Like, they're going to basically penalize people that take the productions outside so they can do more inside, but it's going to cost more. So there's going to be less production. So there's going to be less people working. Like, it seems like you're cutting off your nose to spite your face.
Yeah, the other thing too is it's a digital good. It's no longer a disc. It's no longer a reel of film that's sent, unless it's IMAX, right? There's no longer a reel of film that's sent to the film theaters. It's just an M4A or M4V or whatever it is file format sent to the theater that then projects it, right? It's not, there's nothing physically moving around, right? Ones and zeros, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, anyway, just it's dumb. But so a friend of mine just, you know, owns a prop house in Toronto, and he was a little worried about it when he first heard it. And then his manager said, yeah, don't worry about that. The industry is not going to go anywhere. This stuff happens all the time. And, you know, people still need props. Right. So, because the news story was, you know, they were sort of using the reason why I brought it up was because they were using, CBC was using Strange New World as, you know, the fact that it shot here in Toronto and that it'll have to move somewhere else, right? I mean, that essentially could technically move because it's just a set, you know, it's not like you're not trying to replicate Seattle, you know?
But the other thing that it's doing up here is costing less, right? Like, it, you know, if...
Well, because the government supports it as well, right?
Well, because they want to create jobs. So I think the approach is the wrong one. Don't tariff things. Go the other way and, you know, work with your states, work with your communities, try and build more infrastructure, try and build it. Like, frankly, the United States is a better opportunity to bring those jobs back to America than it does manufacturing. You could subsidize places like, you know, like look what Georgia's done and become a huge hub for filming. New Orleans, there's places all over America that have done a good job of that. You know, if you want those jobs to be in LA again, then work with the government of California and the county of Los Angeles and find ways to make those jobs, you know, more viable, to make the incentives more appetizing, and the jobs will come back. You can't, like, again, doing it scorched earth is just, it's just not a good solution on so many areas. So, yeah. That being said, I hope that the jobs stay here because there's so many amazing, talented Canadian creators and set designers and costumers and actors and, you know, filmmakers that I think we've proven that there's a valuable resource here to be mined as well.
In spite of what Jaime says.
Jaime, boy, I sure can't wait until they actually film in Seattle for these Seattle-based TV shows.
Coming Toronto for the Toronto-based shows.
Yeah.
No, we're going to use New York or Chicago to stand in for Toronto. That's how we're going to do it.
That's a CGI tower. That's not a real tower.
Well, they can't have, the boys can't have a Voight Tower anymore if they can't film in Toronto.
Yeah, really. If they don't have Massey Hall, what are they going to do?
Yeah. It was something else I saw the other day. I was thinking, I watched something that, you know, the Avengers Tower that we saw in Thunderbolts?
Mm-hmm.
There's another show that has a tower like that I was watching the other day, and I was thinking, it's like a lift from the MCU, right? I'm trying to think what it was.
I mean, did you go see Thunderbolts yet?
I have not, no.
Yeah. Is it your intention? Do you intend to see it in a theater?
I don't think we will, mostly because we've got an older dog that's nearing the end here. So it's like, okay, you know, probably next year we'll be able to go out to the movies and do other stuff. He needs so much medication. It's like, we'd have to leave with like a registered nurse or something to feel really comfortable. Really? So
that Pollo?
Yeah. Poor little guy. Poor little
How old is he now?
Not terribly old, you know, he's 12, but you know, he's got heart condition and everything, so it's like, okay, you know, we'll just sort of wait this out and just watch movies from home for the time being.
Yeah, Max 12 as well, eh? But he's a little bit bigger than Pollo.
Yeah, the bigger dogs are that's probably more in line, so hopefully Mac is...
I thought the little dogs lived longer.
That's my point, that like Pollo's not terribly old, but the heart disease is getting to him, so... Yeah, so he gets to to, you know, go outside, but it's like, okay, do your business, and then we're going to put you in this stroller, this little pet stroller, so you can continue to enjoy the park, but more as a safari.
Interesting.
Speaking of other movies that dropped on Amazon, I saw Baby Girl finally dropped on there this week.
The, yeah, what's the gist of that one, do you know?
It's about a sort of a power dynamic sexual relationship between Nicole Kidman is playing an older woman and this younger man, as she sort of, you know, rediscovers her sexual self. But apparently she's quite excellent. I haven't seen it, but I must admit I'll make some time for it. I'm not a huge Nicole Kidman fan, but I read enough about the story and just about the sort of the power dynamic that goes on in the show that or in the movie that sounds really interesting. I'm curious.
And I think there's a bunch of shows. I'm actually watching Friends and Neighbors on.
Oh, Apple your TV. Friends and Neighbors on Apple. Yeah, is that good? I love John Hamm, but I haven't made time for that yet.
Yeah, Olivia Munn's in it too, and Pitt. What's her name? From the whole nine yards.
Oh, Amanda Peet.
And Amanda Peet, yeah.
I love Amanda Peet. She's great.
She plays the ex. We kind of got to a point where it starts. I mean, the first episode starts with a scenario, and then he flashes back to how it leads to that scenario. We've caught up to the scenario today, or last week, right? So this will be the. So now we're moving into the future. It'll be interesting to see what's going to happen with that. I mean. Yeah, on the tin, it's sort of like, you know, he lost his job. He lives in a really ritzy neighborhood and, decides to, you know, borrow things from his friends, right?
Yeah.
And become a thief, right? So, yeah, it's lots of, you know, of course, then there's twists and turns and, you know, stuff happening in there. But, yeah, it's really interesting. It's compelling. It's good. Kind of a bit like Bad Monkey in that sort of sense. It's sort of stuff just happens, you know, and piles up. So watching that, and of course, I think the studio is an episode coming. They come out on Friday.
I think it was Tuesdays.
Is it? Because we should be due for an episode of that. Let me just have a quick look at the TV app. But anyway, like I said, it's for all intents and purposes, it's Friday now here in Canada Land.
Mm-hmm. Particularly this end of Canada Land.
Yeah, no, the studio is today new, and then Friends and Neighbors is new. So I'm gonna go watch those.
There you go.
Yeah. So until next time.
Until next time, go Leafs, fucking go.
Yeah, how about we didn't talk about them Leafs there.
Yeah.
What the, you know, heck you.
Well, the most.
I didn't watch either of the games.
The most, so it takes 16 wins to win a Stanley Cup. In my lifetime, the most I've ever seen them win in any playoff year has been 11. I've seen them do that twice. Mm. I think we're at 6 now, so we've still got some work to do, but this has been a very impressive start, and all I can do is hope. I can't watch the games. My stomach can't handle it. I just sort of watch along on my phone, and then if things go well, I watch the highlights later. I just can't. At this point in my life, I can't do it to myself anymore.
Can't even.
I've had my heart broken too many times. It's not good for my mental health, so I root from afar. I wish them well, but I just can't.
Yeah, I hear you. So the next game is tomorrow?
It's either tomorrow or Saturday. I don't know. Let's see. I will say it has actually been a good trade-off because I've been watching the NBA playoffs, which have been dynamite.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
am loving that. It's tomorrow.
So in terms of Canadian teams, is Winnipeg out now? Or?
No, Winnipeg, Edmonton, and Toronto are all still in contention. There's three Canadian teams in the last 8, so keep your fingers crossed. If Edmonton and Winnipeg both win their series, they would play in the Western Final and guarantee a Stanley Cup with a Canadian team in it.
Canada, yeah.
And there is still a potential for an all-Canadian final between either Winnipeg and Edmonton and Toronto. So that would be a heck of a thing, considering that a Canadian team has not won a Stanley Cup since the mid-90s. So, yeah, that would be a big deal. But personally, I don't really care what happens to Edmonton and Winnipeg, but, you know, good for them. the two teams I really didn't want to see win the Stanley Cup are already been eliminated, Ottawa and Montreal. Those are, rivals for the Maple Leafs. So I couldn't stomach that. But Yeah, I guess if it had to be another Canadian team, I guess Edmonton and Winnipeg are about the most palatable options. But yeah.
Cool. All right. So we'll call it there. All right, folks.
All right.
Talk to you later.
All right. Night, guys.
Bye. Later.
Bye. Bye.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.